This is Infidel One. Offending Coyote Down. Offending Coyote Down.
Roger that.
Welcome to Trappin' Radio. We're proud, organic, free-range, wild fur farmers of North America.
Let me tell you a little story about how I was raised. Every day work, every day pray. Got family, friends, yeah, everybody sins. A winner never quits, and a quitter never wins. Help folks in need, don't fall for greed. A jealous man is weak, so think before you speak. If you love them, let them know. If you hate, let it go. Fast can be fun, but sometimes you need slow. God is all good, the devil is so real. So listen up, y'all, cause this is how I feel.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got none. Except for the good Lord up above. I answer to no one.
Now let's cover our sponsors. They do a lot to help support Trappin' Radio. So I'm asking you guys out there and gals to help support our sponsors as they keep Trappin' Radio on the air. First sponsors, Oki Cable and Trap Supply. Jeb's the owner of this. He's out of Oklahoma. Super guy. You'll not meet anybody nicer. It's somebody you're going to want to deal with. You can reach him at oktrapsupply.com. You can give Jeb a call at 918-429-4648. Not only does he do trap supply guys, he's a fur buyer, so if you're around the Oklahoma or surrounding states, give him a call with your fur. When you need stuff, give him a call and he'll get it out to you as soon as he can. Our second sponsor is F&T Fur Harvesters Trading Post. Everything you need for trapping, hunting with hounds, and predator calling. Guys, if you're into trapping fur, hunting fur, chasing fur with dogs, you're not going to be able to think of hardly anything that you can't get from F&T. You can reach them at fntpost.com. You can also give them a call at 989-727-8727. Whatever you want, F&T's got. Wildlife Control Supplies. Proven solutions for wildlife control. Delivering value, expertise, and products to the wildlife individual. If you're in the ADC business, control business, even fur trapping, you need to look at these guys' website. Top-notch company. Have everything you would want, even the odd stuff that ADC guys are looking for. You can reach them at wildlifecontrolsupplies.com. You can give them a call at 877-684-7262. International number is 860-844-0101. If you're a wildlife control professional, you need to have Wildlife Control Supplies as one of your favorites on your computer or your phone, because when you come across something that you need specialized equipment, Alan will get it right out to you.
Now let's go trapping.
See, I'm a flag flying, Bible toting son of a gun. Yeah, I'm hell on the heart, just a rebel on the run. Scared, don't know it, fear, don't feel it. The truth is the light, sometimes you gotta fight. Good beats bad, right beats wrong. I'm a barroom preacher and this is my song. I'm climbing for the top, representing for the country. I'm the people's champ, right out to dead camp. Shotgun toter, Republican voter. Hank Jr. supporter, let's protect our border. To hell with anyone who don't believe in the USA. Cause this is what I say.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got.
Welcome to Trapping Across America. This is your host, Clint Locklear, coming from the PCG Compound, located in the Appalachian Mountains in the greatest country in the world. Today we're going to be talking about snaring, 4th of July, trapping conventions, all the good stuff that trappers should seem to like. So that's what we're going to get into. I do want to say for you guys that's coming out to the Kansas show, I will be out there at the FTA next week. Looking forward to that, seeing everybody I haven't seen in a while. Always enjoy going to the conventions. Now this morning, when you know, you get up and you're drinking your coffee and everything, my wife listens to, she's got some type of little speaker thing that goes with her radio, and she's getting ready in the morning. She's going around jamming, and whatever station she was listening to, it was songs from military that they listened to while they were in or going to combat, and it was pretty hardcore stuff. And Cindy was acting really silly, which is always fun. But then she said, well, it's going to be the 4th of July. You should think of something to do about the 4th of July for trapping radio. And I thought about that for a little bit. And guys, I don't really know, at a loss a little bit about that. But it did make me think about one thing that I want to share with you. Think about 4th of July. Think about Independence, Revolutionary War, back when Americans were Americans and freedom actually meant something to people. You had, the militia and all that type of stuff, so you had soldiers. Now, I happened to have been a soldier, and I was over in Desert Storm and Desert Shield, and not that that has anything to do with trapping, except for one part of it. We were sitting probably about 3 miles from Iraq, and we were all staging to do the great big air assault that everybody saw on TV, where it looked like we, blotted out the sky like wasp or something. And before that was going on, you still had stuff you had to do. Now, being military, you had a bunch of ammunitions and stuff going in and out. And we were, as a company, guarding this great big ammo dump, which was pretty cool because there was all kind of neat, cool toys in there. And since the Statue of Liberty limitations is probably over, we did pick up a few extra claymores, grenades, and bandoliers for the M60s. So that was pretty handy in that particular situation. But by this time, we've been in country probably, not in country, but in the region over there for probably 6 months. And literally 90%, 95% of all our meals up to that time were MREs. And, MREs are kind of cool if you go camping, if you've never had them, you've never had many of them. Eating them day in and day out is, there's only 12 selections to go from. You figure out all kind of creative ways to cook. I mean, we could make peach pies and omelets and all kind of stuff out of MREs after 6 months, trust me. But you're just like craving something besides a freaking MRE. I mean, there's a flavor on the back end of every MRE, no matter what the product is. It's just like loaded with some type of funky chemical, I'm assuming, so that it can't spoil, because it's 115 degrees over there and the food doesn't spoil. So you had this funky aftertaste all the time. We're guarding this ammo dump, and we've got all our toys of being soldiers at the time, and we all had PBS-7s, which are night vision, if you don't know what that is. They go on your helmet, and when you're pulling guard duty at night, you always have that thing on your, if you're not looking through them, you have them where you can pull them down and turn them on real quick if you need to see into the night. And so we're sitting around one night, and there's these big rats over in the Middle East. And you can, if you don't know, if you've never really seen one before, you ought to go look it up online. They're kangaroo rats. They're big rats. I mean, they're about the size of an average muskrat or a little bit bigger. They've got this long tail, and they got a puff of fur on the very end of it. And wherever we went, they went, because they would go through the trash, they would get scraps, they would... they would live out in the desert, and they didn't look like a rat. They looked more like a, kind of like a chinchilla with a long fuzzy, ball on the end of its tail. That's more what it looked like to me anyway. They were more of a light brown color. And we're waiting to go into Iraq. We're pulling guard duty. We're sick of MREs. And I'm watching through the night vision all these kangaroo rats run around. And never ate a rat. Never thought about eating a rat. After 6 months of MREs, the rat started looking pretty freaking good, to be honest with you. Looking really good. Anything that actually was meat without laced with whatever that aftertaste was in MREs was looking pretty good to me. So this is the way I'm going to connect 4th of July with trapping. And this wasn't really 4th of July. This would have been probably early February. When this happened, and thinking back to the time when we had to go in and do our deed in the Middle East. But I'm sitting there with the night vision. I'm watching these kangaroo rats. I'm like going, you know, I'm trapping Martin and Fox at home. Surely I can trap a rat. So I'm looking around. How am I going to get one of these things? And you know, all of my, probably for the whole first night, I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to do this. Because I'll be honest with you, the idea of eating something that was fresh meat was looking pretty good. Now, you can't have fires in a combat zone at night because it's kind of a tempting target for people that are trying to do the dirty deed on you. But during the mornings, we would have fires because it was actually cold over there at night. Desert gets really cold at night. So we would have these little fires in the morning. We'd heat up our coffee water and stuff like that and heat up our MREs and different things. So I'm sitting there and I'm seeing all these kangaroo rats running around. So I devolve all the way back to watching Roadrunner and Bugs Bunny and stuff like that. So I get an MRE box, which are pretty tough. I find a stick of some kind. I run some 550 cord to the stick and I get about 70, 80 feet back up on this hill. And I'm thinking rat cheese. So I get some MRE cheese and I put it under the box. And I'm sitting up there with my night visions on, and I'd be looking out over the horizon because you could see if anybody's trying to sneak up on you, probably about 10 miles away. But, you know, I'm looking down at the box, I'm looking out at the horizon, and the first four or five kangaroo rats that tried to get in that box, they were faster than I were. So I'm pulling the string, I got to walk back down the hill, I reset the trap. Well, eventually, I catch one. And then I catch another one, and then I catch another one. So I had three kangaroo rats. So I take it back up to my post. I gut them, skin them, you know, wash them off with my canteen water, different things like that. It's kind of cool at night. I put them in an old MRE bag. The next morning, I can sit around the campfire, and I deboned one of them to make an omelet out of, which was the first thing. And it was really interesting the next morning. Because the guys that were there, they haven't smelled cooking meat in 6 months either. And when I put my canteen on top of the fire, there was a different odor than we've used to been smelling. Now, the meat actually was pretty light looking, and it was not very strong smelling. But so I cooked off some of the kangaroo rat in my canteen, put my omelet mixture from the MRE, put it in there with the cheese and crackers like we always did, and it was pretty good. Well, come lunchtime, I got two more of these kangaroo rats. And everybody that's sitting around me at the time is, ooh, that's gross. I wouldn't touch one of them nasty things. I'm not that hungry yet, this, that, and the other. Well, come lunchtime, I shish kebab the other two muskrats, put salt and pepper on it from the MREs, and I cook it over the fire, just kind of a slow over the coals type thing, rolling that thing back and forth, and what little bit of grease is in that thing is going down and hitting the coals, and it smells like a barbecue. And when I'm looking around with me cooking, all them guys a few hours earlier that were going, that's gross, I would never eat that, they are drooling. It's going down their shirt. You know, they're not making the same comments as fast as they were before. And I get done with the first one. I pull out, you know, what you add to everything when you're in the Army, when you're eating food like that, is Tabasco sauce. I put that on there and ate it. And guys, it was delicious. Now, to be fair about things, I finished cooking the other one. And I just set it on the rock that was sitting next to it. And I just walked off. I came back a minute later and it was gone. Nobody admitted, no one else would admit they would eat the rat, but someone sure as crap did. And that's the only thing I could think of to put trapping and 4th of July together is clean eating kangaroo rats in the Middle East because he's sick of MRE. So there you go. That's the 4th of July connection type thing going on right there. Now, the other thing I want to talk about, and this is, I want you to listen to what I'm saying if you're one of these people that's thinking this way. I did not go to the PA show, and I want to explain why, because I've got a friend that was up there, and a couple of guys said, well, you know, Clint doesn't care about us, he didn't want to come up here anymore or anything like that. Guys, that has nothing to do with this. My appreciation of Pennsylvania trappers has nothing to do with me not going to Pennsylvania. It's not getting out of trapping. I've talked more about some of the agriculture stuff that I do. Guys, I've been doing that for 15 years. So that's not something new or something I'm just getting into. That's always been there. Because that was one of the comments it was saying. And I've been going to the PA show for probably 15 years. Now, part of the reason I'm not going to the PA show is the way the association sets up. Now, and I'm gonna explain my logic here. So when you hear someone else say this, you can tell them the same thing. Pennsylvania has got one of the most aggravating systems in the world to get tables. And after 15 years of it, you really get sick and tired of the game that goes on up there. And, you know, when we're talking about politics and the daily life and, you know, everybody gets upset because this politician, you know, has a lobbyist and they've got a buddy and they go and they give the contract to them and they're making rich and taxpayers are paying for it. All that crony capitalism that just drives people nuts. That's what it's like at the Pennsylvania show. And it's so aggravating to deal with. So this is what happens to a dealer at the Pennsylvania show. You've been at the show, you set up Thursday, you drove all the way up there, probably 10, 12 hours, you set all that stuff up, it's hot, you go to the motel room, you get some food, you come back next day, you're standing up all day, you're having a good time with trappers, but guys, that is exhausting after 8 or 9 hours of doing that. Then you get something to eat, you go to bed. Now, on Friday night, you don't get to sleep till 6 in the morning. You better be getting up about 1:30 in the morning. You get up at 1:30, you're really tired, you drive back to the convention, you sit somewhere, wherever they tell you to sit, like you're a bunch of cattle or something, and you sit there till 6:30 or 7 in the morning. Now, why in the world would a dealer do that? Because the way that they do their table booths, you have to get in line, and it's first come, first serve, which I'm totally fine with that if that's really how it was, but that's not how it is. So you get up at 1:30, and you're trying to be the first three or four in line just so you can get a table. Now, that ought to put a little a ding in your mind there. There's a lot of tables in Pennsylvania. Why do you got to be the first three or four to get a table? This is where the crony part comes in, and after so many years, I'm just tired of dealing with it. I'll be honest with you. I'm tired of dealing with it. You've been up since 1:30. You stand in line. You get up there. You're the third person in line. And when you do, there's only like six tables left in all the buildings. And it's because people that in the convention, they signed their buddies up. They have other buddies that I don't know if they bribe them. I don't know what it is. Don't really care. It's none of my business. But there, you're setting up all that time in the morning, and then you get up there, and you can't even get tables in a decent building, because when you're third person in line, this happened to me, third person in line, and you're in the bad part of the convention where the traffic's going to be low, no one's going to be able to find you, and all this. And let me tell you, that is very frustrating. Now, see, you may be thinking, well, he's just whining. Well, after 15 years of going through this, it's not whining anymore. It's just pure frustration. This year, I didn't go. I had a friend that was fourth in line. Got up at 1:30 in the morning, sat up there, doing nothing but staring at darkness. He gets up there, and when he does, he couldn't even get four tables together. Now, there's only four people in front of him. They weren't buying 90 tables apiece. They were only buying two or three. So the part of the reason that I don't go to Pennsylvania, guys, is that just frustrates me to death. You got to understand who you're listening to. I don't even sell anything in the state of Tennessee because the state of Tennessee tried to play a game with credit cards and kickbacks on sales tax on the businesses here. And once I realized what that was, I just no longer sell to anybody in the state of Tennessee. I'll tell you to go to F&T or Okie Cable and Trap or a Wildlife Control Supplies, something like that. So when I feel or I know that I'm being played as a fool, eventually I go, that's enough. And that's kind of what happened at Pennsylvania. Now, if Pennsylvania ever changes what they're doing,
that's fine. But the only way that I'm going to believe that is when the first person that's been sitting there since, the first person probably was there at 12 o'clock at night, sitting there all night trying to get a table. When he gets up there and there's no tables filled in, I think about coming back to Pennsylvania. So until the cronyism of the association gets straightened out, it's too aggravating. And the other thing about that show, guys, you may not realize this, they're almost as expensive as the Nationals. Now, as the I'm talking strictly from a business point of view right now. This is not about trappers or anything else. This is strictly talking about business. It's a good lesson to learn. They have upped their price to the point where they've overvalued and they undeliver on what the convention is anymore. 15 years ago, yeah, it was what they're trying to get now. Now it's not. That's why in Pennsylvania you're seeing a lot of dealers that don't go. The first person I saw finally get so upset over the price was Kyle Katz. And he just quit going because he wasn't going to pay them for the Nationals at a Nationals price near about for them not giving you the value that you want. And that's a business decision that someone has to make. Now, those two things right there has nothing to do with me not caring about trappers of Pennsylvania. You know, if you think about it outside of your scope, of your individual scope, there's 50 states, there's probably 40 different trapping conventions in those states, and some of those states have two, so we'll bring that back up to 50. The average cost of me to go to a convention, when you put in the gas, the tables, the being on the road with the food, the motels, all that stuff, is about $1,400 to $1,600. Now, if I went to 50 shows to show my love to all the trappers, if I had unlimited money and time, I probably would. $1,400 times 50 is $70,000 to go to conventions. And a person wouldn't make $70,000 going to 50 conventions. So, I mean, there has to be a point, and it's a time thing. You're talking going to 50 shows, you know, good grief, you couldn't do it. Not even counting, you'd be wearing out a vehicle a year to do something like that. So, when people don't come to a convention, sometimes it has nothing to do with it coming to the trapper. The Pennsylvania shows just made it aggravating to deal with association. Now, the members of the Pennsylvania need to straighten that crap out, because you're going to start seeing that happen more and more and more. Because I finally, you know, this year I'm starting to get, not finally, but I'm getting these all these little snide remarks under the breath from other dealers going, that's the smartest move I've ever heard of, not going back and putting up with this. Because it's just aggravating. Now the members, if you want to correct that where somebody doesn't feel so frustrated they don't want to put up with it, then y'all need to correct it yourself. And if y'all are the members and y'all the ones that vote, then y'all have the power to do that. So just keep that in mind. But it has nothing to do with me not wanting to see the people of Pennsylvania. I've got lots of good friends in Pennsylvania. And I'm switching that much time for being away from home. You also got to think, I'm in South Tennessee. You might as well say Georgia or Alabama. And then I'm going almost up to New York and on the New Jersey line to go to a Pennsylvania show that it's overvalued for what it is from a business point of view, and it's aggravating to deal with. When I can drive two more miles into New York and probably see a lot of the same people and have a good time, where the New York State Association is very easy to get along with, and they don't make you sit around for hours on end and then, you know, do all the crazy stuff they do with their booth fees now. So that's what it is. So I'm just, that's just what it is. So you can take that for however it's worth, but that's just someone being as completely and open and honest with their audience as they can be. And if you try to find something negative in that, as far as me not wanting to do something with Pennsylvania, you wouldn't want to do it either. So just keep that in mind. Well, I've got a question here on email, and I've got a couple questions for getting the main topic, because one of the questions leads into the main topic. This is from David, and he says, does this have preservative for meat in the solution? What he's talking about is my bait solution. And I could have wrote back a very simple, quick answer on this and go, yes, it does. But there's an always depends thing that goes on with anything when you're dealing with anything organic. Now, it does. It is loaded with sodium benzoin. As much as I can hold in solution inside of a pint. Now, will that preserve probably 90% of everybody that uses that, the meat that they put it in? Absolutely. It will. But it will not do 100%. So it's kind of one of those things, it's kind of tricky to say whether you need it or not. Now, the reason I say that, when you're dealing with organic matter, especially in meat, you've got a lot of bacteria that meat comes exposed with. What is on your knife? What is on your table when you cut it up? You know, what do you put it in as far as the bag? There, bacteria are these crazy little bugs that can produce, when they get into the right thing, like crazy. Like I can take a sock full of compost and run it through a compost tea maker, and I can turn that little sock full of compost, which is bacteria, I can turn that into 5, 10, 15 gallons in 24 hours of organisms that are as much or more than was in the compost to start with. So that's the volume that bacteria produce when they have food that they need. So when you're talking about meat, like beaver, deer, cow, house cat, whatever it is that you're using, there's a lot of weird stuff that's going on that you don't think about in a particular way. Like when we do commercial lure and bait makers, when we do bait, we use way more sodium benzoin than you would ever need to preserve anything. It's because everybody that's been in this business long enough, and you know, we've learned that's one place you don't try to be cheap on is preservative, because of all these weird little bacteria that's going on. Now, the reason I'm telling you all this, let's say that you're going to do beaver meat. I don't know what meat you're using, David, you didn't say. So say you're going to be using beaver meat. If it's normal bacteria and nothing's weird happening going on, yeah, you'll be fine. No problem whatsoever. But if you've got something that is, and you're talking microscopic of something going on, and it gets on the meat from a knife or your table or in the back of the truck or whatever it is, it may be producing the bacteria at such a rate that the sodium benzoin cannot contain it. And you would need to add more. And it's a simple way to get around this. If we're using my bait solution, or I can't speak for other lure makers, but probably other lure makers, a good safe thing for you to do if you're using a bait solution, because bait solutions are pretty cool. It's a very economical way to get a bigger volume of meat. So if you catch a beaver and you taint it or use it fresh, whatever your flavor is on that, and then you get a bait solution, you can have a commercially made, all the goodness that we put in our baits in a bait solution, and put it for, you know, $15, $19. I think mine's $19. So for $19, you get a gallon. Now, if you order a gallon from me, you're talking $80. So you can see there's a $60 savings there. That's why bait solutions are really cool. But at the same time, it's hard for a lure maker to guarantee anything when it comes with somebody else, with the way they're cutting or tainting, or the buckets they put it in. Are they clean? Are they not clean? We have no idea, and we have no control as bait makers. So my advice to anybody that's going to be using a bait solution is, when you mix it up, put it somewhere where you can see it for at least a couple of weeks. So you're mixing that stuff up, and because most bait solutions need probably 5-7 days before it truly gets married with the meat, so it does what it's supposed to do. Sodium benzoin by itself does not preserve most meats shorter than 4 days. So you've got that 4 days. Now it'll almost completely stop it pretty quick, but you're still going to have some gas buildup. So what you'll do is you'll have your bait bucket, whatever you're using, make sure it's got a lid that you can keep flies and stuff out of. And then once you put it in there, the next day, just go crack the lid and burp it. That's what we call burping bait. So you see if any gas is coming off of it. Now then you come around and you go, okay, it's been 4 days, and then I'm going to burp this thing again. And you see if there's gases coming off of that. And then let that sit for a couple of days before you touch it again. and you go over, and if there's very little gas coming off that, you're probably good. But if it seems like it did, like the first day that you did it, you'll need to add some more sodium benzoate or zinc valerate or some type of preservative that you want to use. Now, it could be as simple as salt if you want to go that way. But sodium benzoate, I would add probably in a gallon. If I was having that problem myself, I'd add another cup of sodium benzoate stirred in. That's probably going to fix everything. No matter how bad it is at that point, with as much as in my bait solution as that, I mean, you can probably put pretty much the guts of an animal in that much sodium benzoate would pretty much stop everything. So it's up to you, the person using the bait solution, to kind of watch what's going on with your own bait. So if it seems like it's still wanting to burp on you after, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 days, you'll need to add some more sodium benzoate or preservative of some kind, and then you'll probably be good to go. Now for 95-90%, I don't know what it is, there's enough in there that you won't need anything. And I would say other bait solutions from other guys that make it, they're probably the same way, as far as they probably put so much in there anymore and it falls out of solution. So they're probably doing the same thing I'm doing as far as getting that much bait, that much sodium benzoate, or maybe even another type of preservative in there. So just keep that in mind when you're using any bait solution. You need to kind of be part of the process also. It's not like I can do anything I want on my side and this has got to fix it. You've got to kind of work with it, because you're dealing with bacteria and breaking down meat and all kind of, you know, funky little things that are growing on stuff. So just keep that in mind when you're doing it. Now, I'm going to the New York show this year. I didn't get to go last year, mostly because the NTA and the New York were so close that I've been 4,000 miles of driving in 1 month for two shows. And that just didn't make a whole lot of sense. And so I didn't go. But there's some cool things that's going on at the show. I just want to go over a few of them real quick. There's 56 inside vendors. They're going to have a lot of raffles, which they normally do. They have a kids pack basket that they raffle every day. There's a barbecue chicken dinner on Friday night. They have their general meeting on Saturday. There's a lot of camping goes on there. The New York show is kind of a neat atmosphere. So if you're in the area, you got to go check it out. It is a pretty neat one. With a lot of demos. You're going to have Newt Sterling giving one on snares and cables, J.P. Wilson on canines, Baxter on water trapping, Bob Shout on Fisher trapping, Harry from F&T is going to be giving one on Ron raccoons, Doug Chubb is going to be giving one on cables. I would definitely pay attention to that if you're looking to get into snaring. Big Daddy Jeff Dunlap is going to be giving one on beaver. Night Owl Lures on lure usage, Blowthrum on beaver needs 2 inches of water possible. That's interesting, not sure what that one is. Robinson on canines, Zagger on canines, he's always very entertaining. Mark Carpenter on Fisher, Comstock's been doing cages, he's always got some really really good information on cage stuff. Freeborough on water sets. Gilbert on coyotes. I'm going to be doing one on otter and bobcats. Dave Rogers on fox. Scott Painter on bobcats and coyotes. Mace Lures on making wax dirt. Donald Graves on canine water trapping. That could be very interesting. And Paul Arkeman on the history and future of the American chestnut. I'll be going to that one. That's kind of cool, actually. So those are the demos that's going to be going on. So I mean, that's pretty power packed there of the different things, and the some of these are really, really intriguing because they are different, like water canine trapping. I've got some sets I do with that I'm curious. I'd be curious to see if we're doing the same thing or not. And a lot of these other guys, like Zagger's, always just funny, entertaining, and different things. And so if you're going to be in the area, go up there and go to the show, because you'll really enjoy it. Okay. Send. Okay, now we're going to get to the main topic, and this is based off of what we're going to start with. Well, a question, and this is not what I was going to do the show on, but it led me down a road that I thought would be kind of neat for us to go down. Now, this is from Trey, and he runs a. I'll just read it. He said, "Hey, Clint, I run a charter boat in Destin, Florida. I have access to lots and lots of fish carcasses. My question is, if fish piles work for bait and coyotes if I'm snaring at bait piles. Never tried it, but I felt like I'd asked beforehand. I appreciate your thoughts on this." First off, dude, you're talking to someone who loves to go to Destin and bring back a bunch of fish. So when you hear this, do me a favor and email me what your boat is, what you do. Me and my wife, normally we won't be doing it this year. We'll probably be going in the spring maybe, but I would like to be able to go out with another trapper and go fishing. That would just be cooler and snot to me. So if you'll email me back with some more information about your boat, that way I can print it off and put it somewhere where I can find it. So maybe we can go out and tie some stuff up together, because normally when I do go to Florida, just to let you know, I'm going for meat. We eat off that for quite a bit. We just had a big old side of king mackerel the other night that we got with Joey Van Dyke and his charter guide off the outer coast of North Carolina. So, I mean, this is something I'm really into. So it's really cool to know that I've got a chance to go to with a trapper to go fishing. And if someone else is going to Destin, Florida, or Fort Walton Beach, or 30A, or even Panama City, if you're going down there and you want to go out with a trapper, I would look up and I would just Google Terry, W-I-N-D-E-S, boat. And if not, once I get that information, if you're curious about going, email me and I'll get that to you. But your question about the coyotes and the baits. Yes. On our Coyote KS video, when I was going snaring with Matt Jones, he's a commercial fisherman, and he was catching these big head carp, and we were using those things at bait stations all over the place. And one morning, if I remember right, off one of those bait stations, we either caught three or four coyotes in a 24-hour check off of those things. So do fish work? Absolutely. Everything likes fish. It breaks down quick, especially in Florida. You'll probably have to keep adding to it a lot. I wouldn't try to salt it at an actual bait station. So, you know, and you're probably going to have plenty of it to use. You could probably store a bunch in a freezer and go throw it out. It's going to act like a call bait station, or like a long distance call bait station, because it's going to stink to high heaven. And even if the coyotes don't want to eat it, they're going to want to roll in it. They're going to want to wear that goodness like perfume. So, you know, keep that in mind. It's not always about the food. Sometimes it's about them wanting to wear it like perfume. So, yes, I would definitely be keeping some of that stuff. And it's a shame I can't figure out how to get like a tandem dump truck of that up here, because I'd like to be able to use it on my fields up here. But and the way that I would use it, so that is what it is. The big answer is yes. And I had someone email me wanting me to do some stuff about snaring, then this email came in. So we're going to talk a little bit about bait stations. And if you're not in a state that allows you to snare, if you ever go out of state, try to pick somewhere that does, because it's a really cool skill to get. And it's really fun, because if you've never got to do it before, you'll be kind of amazed how successful you can be snaring without as much skill level or as experience as you need in other things, as long as you keep some different things in mind. You know, like loop sizes and trails and having good locks and all that stuff, which we've talked about before. But I do want to talk about bait stations, because it's a really cool subject if people use it. Some of the biggest catches on coyotes in the last 20 years have come up from the Montana and Canadian border, even into Canada, off of snares. There's guys up there that get all the pig scraps from the the farmers in different places, and they're putting pig stuff out everywhere. There's guys that are using beaver and deer carcasses and all kind of stuff because it is so cold up there, and the way that their check laws are, they're running hundreds of these bait stations. And they may have a check with 40 or 50 coyotes at a check. Now, that may be over 10 days, 2 weeks. Everything's frozen, you know, anyway. But the biggest catches for the least amount of energy is going to be coyotes and bait stations, if you're thinking about coyotes anyway. So it's a very powerful tool and aspect for a trapper to use. There's no doubt about that. And I want to go over a few different strategies. I wrote down some notes just thinking back of some of the good and bad that I've learned from my own personal experience with bait stations. Now, the simple bait station that most people think about is a big pile. And that definitely has merit. Now, when you're looking at your bait station locations, guys, think about you wanna pick a place. It's up to you as the trapper to pick the place. You're gonna pick the place that you can control the coyotes when they're trying to get to your bait. So if you're gonna like one of the things that I learned from Matt, if you went out to a really tall field and you drove your truck, your four-wheeler out there, you're gonna make these little trails. And then you can just kind of drive around in a circle and put a couple of crossroads in there and then dump your fish in the middle and put snares in all the tire tracks. Deadly, you know. But a lot of places, especially when you get farther up north, you're going to have so much vegetation die off that may not work that well. So you're going to have to pick places, and this will work in the south too. You need to pick out places that are close to travel ways, and we find travel ways very easily by tracks or by using Google Earth and seeing how coyotes are going to skirt around stuff. And then when you find these places, you're going to set up inside of the thickest cover that you can get that has some form of trails in it. And you don't want to just throw it in like up in Alaska. When I was up there, you would get in some of these willows and birch clumps, and it was clear on the bottom and it was thick, but it was animal could go absolutely anywhere through that. You want to pick a place that's got a lot of primrose and blackberries and, you know, dead brush on the ground, so you can kind of tell sort of where the coyotes are going to try to get to the bait from. So that's up to you to pick a place like this. And once you pick a place like this, you've got some options on how to use it. And the main one that most people do, or when they think about bait stations, is a big pile. You get a big, 35, 40 gallons of fish and dump it on the ground, or it could be deer carcasses, or it could be dead cows or dead horse or whatever it is, or you're collecting house cats off the road and putting them in the freezer all summer and you go put out 15 or 20 house cats. And you're putting everything in one big pile. And since you pick the area that you're going to put your bait station, then you kind of look at, okay, how are the coyotes going to come in? You know, what is the easiest way to get in there is probably the first place you'll set up. How did you get in there to do that? So think about that. And then you got to start thinking about, okay, a coyote being his nature is going to be looking around and going, okay, that looks pretty good. That may look a little too good. Why is there all of a sudden all this meat out here for me to eat? And they may get a little nervous, which is in their nature, which is fine. So what you'll find with a big bait station is the most obvious ones will definitely catch coyotes. No question. But the other little trails and other little ways that they can sneak in from the back and the side, especially downwind of these things, you know, in between trees or bushes or something like that, those normally pick up actually more coyotes than the main ones that we as people pick to get in there. That's my experience anyway. Because you did something that is very unnatural. They want to eat it or roll in it. But they're not always just going to run in there like a house dog going to an alpo bowl. So you got to keep that in mind. But that's a big bait station. Now the other one are separate piles. I personally like this one more than the big bait, just one big pile in the middle. it gives it more of a natural feel that I believe. So if I've got, say, 50 gallons of fish, you know, and if you know somebody that's in the bow fishing, they shoot hundreds and hundreds of pounds of fish and don't do anything with them. Well, you need to be the collection point for that. So you got all these fish. You go in, you got 55 gallons of fish. You're setting up a bait station. Instead of putting it in one pile, once you pick your area that we were talking about before, what if you put out four or five, you know, 5 gallon bucket piles in separate areas, you know, off the side of some of the trails, some in the middle of the trails, you know, some in the thicker part where they almost cannot get into it no matter what. So what you do is you're causing more interest and more curiosity to the animal when he comes up. And it's kind of like an Easter egg hunt. We're at the grocery store and we go into the grocery store as a kid and we go get some eggs. Well, they're on the back wall. You go in there, they got a hole, you know, they got shelves on them, so you pick an egg. Not very exciting, nothing going on. Same kid, you go hide the eggs all around, and then you tell them to go find some eggs. Now there's a little bit of game to it. There's some interest, there's some fun, trying to figure everything out, trying to, you know, be the first one, which is a big point, to find the prize. And you get a lot more interaction going on with that coyote. So if you spread your bait pile out instead of one pile, you get more of this interest. And you can do that with four or five different people. Now, one of the techniques that I learned from O'Gorman was, he didn't call it this, but I don't know else what to call this. It's like bait pile chaos. That's what we're doing, is we're causing chaos. So if you go out in a real thick area, instead of dumping in piles, this is just a different strategy. Not saying that one's better than the other, it's just a different strategy. When you walk in there, throw that crap everywhere. In the trail, off the trail, try to throw some up in the trees. If you're going to try to bait station a big thicket that's 50 yards across, spread that out over the whole 50 yards. Piece here, piece there, piece here, piece there. And we're getting more into the Easter egg hunt mentality. But we also get more into the scarcity mindset of a predator. And that's where it becomes a little bit cooler. And the way that a coyote family is set up. So if you put a big pile, they're not like human beings. They don't think of the kids first. They don't think of mama first. Big bad alpha dog is the one that gets to eat first. And you got all these coyotes that want to come in and eat, but they're standing back because they know if they go in too early, they're going to get their butt kicked. And then you've got it all in one place. Now, if you've got the separate piles, now the alpha male cannot control all those piles. He's going to go and eat, and no one's going to mess with him because they're going to start looking around, smell something else, and they're going to go find their own little pile. But every time you do this, you're still dealing with the social structure of a coyote. So you're going to have the alpha female that's going to be keeping the pups off and different things like that. The chaos bait pile is you get a thicket and you literally throw the stuff everywhere. And that way you completely take down any type of the social structure of the hierarchy of a coyote. And that's really important for this type of thing to work. So you're going into a great big thicket. You throw this stuff everywhere. You got trails, set the trails up. You know, if you can see or make or walk or weed eat or drive or whatever you need to do, if you can kind of find trails that are not going straight to stuff, but more like in circles or arcs around it, even on the outside of the thicket, you know, it'd be a good place maybe to try to find a place where the thicket goes up to some trees. They'll really hug that cover. They're going to do a lot of circling. They're going to do a lot of walking. They're going to do a lot of trying to figure out what in the world's going on. And then now you've got the family structure totally disassembled, and you've got all this bait everywhere. Every coyote in the group can go eat it without getting their butt kicked. And because of the scarcity type mentality that goes on inside of coyotes, when you spread all that stuff out, all of a sudden a coyote's going to go and he's going to eat just a piece because he's only going to find a piece because you spread it out everywhere. And he's going to see all his brothers and sisters that are eating a piece. But he's going to smell more that's there. So what's he going to do? he's going to run to find the next piece, just like an Easter egg hunt for kids. And when he goes to run to find the next piece, you've got all your snares set up in all these different locations inside of this thicket, and they're gonna come in contact with your stuff really, really quick. And it builds on top of that, because once you snag a coyote inside of that thicket with all that food and all the family structures broke down, but they still, you know, the big dogs still want to somewhat be in control. Now you've got a coyote that's swinging and struggling and peeing and making noise and everything else. You just kicked up the intensity level of what's going on with those coyotes 1,000%. Now, when the mom tries to go help the one that's caught, she's going to be probably coming in contact. All of a sudden now, mom's caught, the pup's caught, and the other pups are running around just like kids were if something crazy happened, and they're running into snares. Dad's going to be trying to figure out what to do. He's going to be moving around. He gets caught. Now, see, that's the difference to me of using strategy when it comes to snaring. Using the piles, there's nothing wrong with that. Separating the piles is better. A chaos bait pile to me is the best. And like if you're out west, when I was watching how Craig explained what he did, he would drive up to a great big sage thicket and he would just throw meats and bones and stuff in all different directions, and then he'd go set up places in between the bushes, and he would wear coyotes out doing that. Very different from the bait style that we mostly think about. Okay, now you also got to think about your weather when you're thinking about bait styles, guys, because it's important. If it's really warm or it's going to be warm, most of the time the action on those cool off. So these work better when it's going to be the coldest it's going to be. And better yet, if you can wait till it's cold for a couple of weeks, you start go putting these out. Now you can go out all summer long and just throw out a couple of pieces of meat in this thicket. They will definitely get used to come checking it out. But to actually set it up and have to go back and check and stuff, wait till the weather's cooler and you'll have a lot better luck. And you can set up lines of these things. You know, it won't be as tight together probably in the east as the trap line would be, but your percentages go up. And if you were to really dedicate yourself for 1 month or 2 weeks of running nothing but bait stations for coyotes, watch what happens to your number. And that's kind of like the fur choice right now, that bobcats on the fur market that we're going to have somewhat of a market for. So if you set these lines up, you know, you can actually run just snare lines. And it's very gentle on you to do. Setting up snares should not be hard. It should be fairly fast. Remakes are pretty easy. You know, you can go to a thicket, put out 20 or 30 snares, and then go to the next one, put out 20 or 30 snares. And when you're running your snares and you catch a cow, don't worry about putting it back. Just cut the cable and get your animal and get out of there. So it's pretty easy to use. Now, a really good place to use something like a bait pile that may not come across as the same way as thinking about it in a classic thicket bait pile are beaver dams, dikes, and levees. When you have water on both sides and you put food in the middle, you really funnel the animal in to go to where you want. Most beaver dams, you go throw out two or three beaver carcasses on that thing. Watch what happens in over the tracks in the next couple of days. It'll be full of coyotes and bobcats and coons and fox and everything else. So by putting it, and that's like the smallest, narrowest type of dike or levee I can think of. But, you know, you've got trees growing up and stuff. You could use even blind sets, but the water and the freezing, it's hard to beat the snares at that point. So you can set these beaver dams up. You may have to get creative. You may have to somewhat plant a couple of bushes or trees to give you some structure, but you can wear them out. Now, on dikes and levees, a lot of times, if they're overgrown, there's going to be a two-track that go over these things. And if it's not mowed down to the ground, those two tracks are where you put your snares. So you drive out on that levee, get about out in the middle somewhere, start throwing some of that meat around, and then you'll go back on the way that you were coming in and set three or four snares in each tie rut, and then drive forward till you get towards the end and put three or four snares in each tie rut. Now, if you're dealing on private property, let the landowner know you're doing this. Because I can tell you that you can catch a coon hunter by the foot on a four-wheeler, and when he comes to a complete end of the stop of that snare, there's some high intensity going on between him and the trapper. So take my personal experience on that one. You can catch people if you don't let them know. So if you're on private land, let the landowner know that you're going to be doing this way. Now, guys, when you're thinking about bait stations, don't be cheap with your snares. Don't try to get in the screwy mindset of, I can go set 10 snares and catch 10 coyotes. You know, if that's just something you want to do because it's like a personal goal, maybe? I don't know. That's one way to do it. But if you want to catch a lot of stuff with snares, you need to set a bunch of snares, which means you got to have systems in place to set those snares fast, so you're not sitting there goofing around a lot. But don't be stingy with them. That's one of the biggest offenses that a snareman can do if he wants to catch a bunch of stuff is going to be being stingy with snares. Set them heavy. They're pretty cheap. If you make a catch, you know, you've done good. If you don't make a catch, you go set it at the next bait station when you pull them. So you're either going to have an animal or not. So, you know, it's pretty cool how that works. Now, where do you get the meat to do this? Let's say you're a coyote trapper and you're in beaver country, but that's not your thing. That's cool. Well, there's a lot of beaver trappers around you that the aggravating part of most beaver trappers is dealing with the carcasses. So set up a route where you go collect their carcasses. You know, most of them will give them to you, or you can trade something or something like that. But that's a simple way. Figure out different ways to do that. Go talk to the smaller slaughterhouses. A lot of times, you know, especially with the guts and bones and different things like that, there's a chance they'd be willing to give you that. You know, be in contact with the farmers, especially if you're around Amish people. You know, they have, you get cows that go down, you get horses that go down, donkeys that go down, different things like that. If you've got somebody that's doing a bunch of small-scale free-range poultry, and five or six of them get killed one night, and they know that you'll come get the carcasses and take care of them for them, you can go set them up that way. When I'm doing a lot of snaring like this, I normally have a couple of freezers that I start stocking up ahead of time. One of my favorite places to go to is I go become friends with the guys that do the deer processing. You know, no one keeps the legs. There's still meat left on those things. You know, if it's a doe, there's probably going to be a skull with meat on it and part of the neck. You know, the rib bones still have some meat on there, different things like that. You can, if you get hooked up with them during the season, you can go fill up truckloads for meat. You know, if you know someone that's into fishing, you know, have them keep the heads, someone that's into commercial fishing, different things like that. Just be creative about what it is. Don't get so locked in that I've got to have the, you know, this is the best of whatever it is. Just get them something to eat and something to roll in, and you're probably good to go. Now, there's some laws in some states that you've got to be aware of. Throwing carcasses out, even from a game warden's point of view, can be considered like littering, and they've got some weird laws, especially the more northeast you get. Well, I had a guy call me, and he was saying how they were going to give him a ticket, and they took the ticket back, and eventually, and it worked out for him, but they came across a carcass pile on his own property, and they were giving him a hard time about it, and they were trying to cite these laws that no one's ever heard of and normal government stuff. So what I would say, you know, if this is an issue where you're at and you're going to be running bait piles, one way that I could see that now, what I'm getting ready to tell you, the game warden's going to know that you're full of crap. But who cares if he knows you're full of crap about what you're doing? It's going to be hard for him to write you a ticket, because putting bait carcasses out, there's nothing ethically or morally wrong with this. Now, one thing that is USDA approved is making compost with animal remains and wood chips. That is a government approved sanctioned thing for soil fertility. So if you're going to run a bunch of bait piles and you know that you're going to have a game warden that's going to be giving you a hard time, you can get wood chips free and you can put them somewhere in your yard or find someone's got a farm somewhere or some land that you can dump a pile of this stuff on there. And then when you go to put your bait pile out, wood chips are light. They don't weigh very much. If you have to do this, you could cover those carcasses with wood chips. Trust me, it is not going to make one bit of difference to the coyotes. But what you're doing is you're giving yourself some cover. So if a game warden goes, it's illegal to dump those carcasses, you go, I didn't dump no carcasses. I'm making compost. Now, he's going to automatically look at you sideways. He's going to know that you're full of crap. But it's not what they know, it's what they can prove. And then you go, according to the USDA, which I suggest that you look at, sir, is compost is a mixture of animal parts and wood chips, and that is what I'm doing. I'm making compost. Well, why are you making compost in the middle of the field? Thinking I may try to plant something here. You know, whatever you want to say. But you got the action away from throwing out the carcasses to something that's positive. You know, that's this goes back to a line of thought. There's the guy that started permaculture was really big into the financing of sustainable farms, and he really got big into the nonprofits and the trusts and the funds and all that. And he said lawyers like working with him, and actually his nickname with a couple of lawyers was the devious bastard, because he would look at the laws and he'd figure out a way that he could still do what was moral and ethical, and it would almost, you know, give the middle finger to someone that didn't want him to do that just out of pettiness. And a carcass pile, for the most part, if you're throwing it on the side of the road, guys, I mean, yeah, you're going to get in trouble. But if you're doing this somewhere else, you can at least say, this is a, you know, I'm following regulation. I'm making compost. Go away. And, you know, they may change that in the state or something, so you got to pay attention. But that's one way. That's what I would do. I mean, around here, it's never been an issue. But if it ever becomes an issue, I'm going to be making more compost than I make now. And I would challenge them to prove that I'm not making compost, because I'll pull out the regulation and let them try to prove that in court. And they're not going to go that far, trust me. Now, you know, most guys think about road lines when they're thinking about this snaring type stuff. Don't forget the river. Don't forget that you can do this out of a boat or a canoe or even a kayak. You know, it's a little harder to get the meat out there, but you're also going to be dealing with less eyes to deal with. You're going to be able to get into places you probably can't get to by roads, different things like that. There's a lot of coyotes, cats, and fox that are on the side of rivers and stuff like that. You can pick out the big thickets, load them up with some bait and stuff like that, hang your snares, come back and get your stuff. It's a way with a boat or a canoe. You don't have to carry as much equipment once you get your baits out there, because you're just dealing with snares. And you can rock and roll. Now, one of the mistakes you can make with bait stations, guys, is you every time you go in to check, you're making new trails. If you're walking in and making new trails, you're making new trails for the coyotes to also walk down, and your snare's not going to be there. So you walk down the trail, or better yet, get as close as you can and then understand where your stuff's at and use binoculars. Even if you're 20 foot away, because snares can disappear on you. But don't, because I mean, I've done this myself, is the reason I've seen this. You're going to a thick area, you don't want to step over the snares, you're worried about scent, so you're taking a different path. After 3 or 4 days, the coyotes start using that path. Now you got to put a snare on that path, and check them, you're going to make a new path. And it becomes insanity after a while, so you don't want to do that. Now, one thing that you got to keep in mind is bait stations, for me anyway, seems to, the catches come in waves. And the waves are big. And when there's no waves, it's pretty slim picking. So it's not quite like, you know, you can average 3 coyotes a day for the most part when you're doing stuff like this. Most of the time it's, You know, you may catch a coyote here or there, then all of a sudden you'll have 8 or 10. And then you'll have a couple, then 12. You know, I mean, that's just the way it works. So if you understand that, the way you don't get so down in the mouth about a daily catch. Because what you're really interested in it is the overall catch. Because if someone's catching 5 coyotes a day, and then someone catches more than them, but they have several days that are 1 or 2, at the end result, it's better off with the guy that catches more coyotes. And with the that's just part of, and coyote trapping's kind of the same way if you really keep records on it. You make catches in waves. But it seems to be more exaggerated when it comes to the snares. Now, the cool part about the snares is the wave is usually big enough, if you've got enough of these out, that, I mean, you're really flying high because you've got a truckload of coyotes, you know, on those days. So that's just definitely one thing to keep in mind. Now, I want to say kudos to Britain for getting out of the EU. I think that's an amazing thing they did over there. You know, this has nothing to do with trapping, but I'm not a big fan of Britain, but one country telling a bunch of other politicians that they don't need to listen to me anymore to me is pretty cool. So I want to say kudos to Britain about that. If you haven't listened to The Meat Trapper, which is also on Trapping Radio now, I suggest you go listen to it. It's some pretty cool stuff. Tim's a great guy that does that, and he's very intelligent. It's a different perspective on stuff, but it's really good. Now, to close out, guys, the library special, which is, I think I'm calling it, let me see what I am calling that thing. It's on howtotrapit.com. It's like an educational video package, I think is what I'm calling it. It's $199. You get all of my DVDs. That's all of them. But I want to break this down to you to show you how big of a value this is. And it's really simple to do. You go to howtotrapit.com. You register as a member. And then when you click on videos, you'll have to log in. And when you log in, you'll have to have your username and password that you will get from the membership. And then you will buy it just like you would buy a trap. It's the same thing as that. That's $199. It's for all my videos. Now, inside of this, it's 21 different videos because I've actually counted the hours and I did all this. I want to break this down. It's 21 videos. That's also the two from Randy Smith, Combines and Coyotes, Boars Gone Wild, and Scott Adams, 5x5 Tactical. That's in the 21. When you buy that, you're saving $567. To order them all together, it'd be $766. Now, when you break this down, that means you're getting an hour of trapping instruction for $4.14. That's what, like half of minimum wage near about? So, I mean, think about the deal of that. And if you're spending on individual DVDs $39 and $49, when you break this down, you're getting every one of my DVDs for the average price of $9.47. So it's a bigger commitment at the front end. The value is definitely there on the back end. So the next time you're looking at buying a $39 value, you just think that you could have this membership, and as soon as you buy it, you can start watching it right then. So that's at howtotrapit.com. Hope all y'all have a good 4th of July. Now, I'm going to be in Kansas next week, so I don't think there's going to be a show. So, I don't know, maybe Chip will pull one off. I don't know. I haven't talked to him. If he does or not, you know, I'm not putting pressure on him. But I probably won't be able to do that from being on the road like that. So there probably won't be a show next week. But everybody have a good 4th of July. Have fun with your family. Try not to sweat too much. And just be as American as you can be.
I was restless and ready to give Nashville a try. I rolled into town with a sound of my own. Somewhere between Jennings and Jones. Well, the day job I landed felt just like a jail. I couldn't seem to break out with that hammer and nails. And I spent all my nights in some old honky-tonk. Somewhere between Jennings and Jones. Hanging out in the bars with the drunks and the stars, I found a few good old boys just like me. Started burning our candles, both ends and the middle, a bunch of roaring outlaws at high speed. They said that the end of that road I was on was somewhere between Jennings and Jones. Well, some record executives found me one night. I was singing half lit. They said it sounded just right. Right. Put my name on an album, but they shelved all my songs. Said I was somewhere between Jennings and Jones. Hanging out in the bars with the drunks and the stars and a few good old boys just like me. Burning our candles, both ends and the middle, a bunch of roaring outlaws at high speed. And they said that the end of that road I was on was somewhere between Jennings and Jones. Now to find me in a record store won't take you long. I'm right there between Jennings and Jones.